This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
It is a scorching weekend here in the Valley. We appreciate you spending some time with us. Hopefully you got the radio on by the pool because it is hot out there. Someone else feeling the heat. The Obama administration is feeling some heat. There's a lot of issues going on. Scandals, if you will. We are going to break down each of these legally. And to do that, we brought in former Principal Deputy Solicitor General of the United States and former ASU Law Dean Paul Bender. Thanks so much for being here, sir.
Glad to be here.
Well, Paul, thank you for coming. And I want to start out with kind of the hottest issues, the IRS, AP, maybe even Benghazi. There are legal implications of each of those. When we talked about this, you indicated you don't think most people really understand what's going on in terms of the legal side of these issues. Let's take the IRS first.
Right.
You say the IRS, and most people feel helpless, and it's easy to make them see red.
Right.
What are the issues involved with the IRS right now?
You're talking about the issue regarding their surveillance of, or interrogation of, or targeting, I think is the word that's used, of conservative groups that were applying for tax exempt status.
Yes, there was a group of civil servants, as I understand it, in a Cincinnati office, and they are charged with overseeing the applications for tax-exempt status for certain groups.
Right.
And they, I think, to cut down on their workload, they did a computer search for the word Tea Party.
Yeah, well, that wasn't the only word they did a computer search for. I'm not sure exactly what all the words, keywords they put in. But what they were trying to do is, and I think this is something people may not understand, the decision they were making is whether these groups, they're all going to be tax-exempt, but there are two categories of tax-exempt groups that are not charitable groups. Social welfare groups and political groups, you don't get a tax deduction for giving them money, but they don't pay taxes themselves on their income. They don't have much income, but they're tax exempt. Their receipts are not taxed. But they're two different categories. One are political organizations, and the other, I think, is called social welfare organizations. And the difference between them is that the political organizations have to reveal their donors, and the social welfare organizations don't. The social welfare organizations are allowed to do some election politics, but it can't be the primary thing they do. The IRS gets thousands and thousands of applications for the social welfare status. And a lot of those are applications by groups that do a lot of political activity. It's a big problem. And some of them are enormously large groups that spend a lot of money on election campaigns and yet are in the category of social welfare groups, so they don't have to reveal their donors. And that's why they want that status. And so the IRS is charged with deciding whether the group is primarily engaged in elective activity or it's only something they do, but it's not primary. And so they have this big pile of applications, and the people who work there, who are not political people, they're career employees, were trying to figure out how to go through these things. And apparently they picked out some key words, including Tea Party and patriotism and, I don't know, some other things. They're not all words that pertain only to conservative groups. And they picked those out of the applications for additional scrutiny to try to find out whether they really deserve that status or whether they were primarily political and election organizations. And somehow that's thought to be a scandal. That doesn't strike me as a scandal at all. It strikes me as something they should be doing. That category of the tax law is really, really misused.
Well, we've talked about that here in past weeks. That's actually really a form of money laundering. The money goes into a group like this. They, in turn, give the money to a political group, and because it got laundered through this social welfare group, then the ultimate recipient doesn't have to report who the original source of the money was.
Yeah, you don't know where the money came from. Right, and that's what's at stake in these cases.
So what's the culpability in a case like this, or of the president or of the administration, if there isn't evidence that they ordered this?
The answer to that is none. There's no culpability of anybody who didn't order it. Whether this is something that's culpable or not, I don't know, because I don't know what the targeting was comprised of. If they asked obnoxious questions, no one claims that they denied the status to anybody. Yeah,
that's also my understanding that none of these groups actually had their status denied.
It's all about the investigatory process, and apparently they sent questionnaires out to the groups that they suspected might be too political, and some of the questions were thought to be too broad and too intrusive.
What if they knew about it, the administration, but didn't do something to stop it? Is there potential culpability there?
You mean legal culpability?
Well, legal and political are two different things. Well, let's start with legal.
No, there wouldn't be any potential legal culpability there. I'm not sure that there's any culpability even of the people who did that. Uh-huh. And even if they did it in a politically biased way, I don't know what, it might violate some law, but I don't know what it would be. But
it certainly is politically unseemly.
Well,
it looks
sure.
Like you say the IRS, and the word intimidate.
Right. If people in the IRS decided to take out after people based on the politics of the people they were taking out after, and do intrusive, obnoxious, oppressive things to them, deny them statuses that they're entitled to, raise their taxes, if they did something like that, that would be, I hope, politically unfavorable to them, and maybe even legally.
Okay, we got a minute and a half. What about the AP case? That's a case where there was a national security investigation, but some people think that the request from the Justice Department to the AP was overbroad. What's involved there?
Again, we don't know exactly what the background of that is. I think all we know is that the Justice Department subpoenaed the phone records of, I think, 20 reporters at the AP. That doesn't mean they listened to the phone conversations. It means they subpoenaed the records of what phone conversations they had, who the other end of the conversations was. And they did that in an attempt to find a leaker. There had been a leak of some very, very sensitive information, which was potentially quite dangerous to the United States. It ended up not being dangerous, but the leak was the kind of thing which, if it happened again, would be dangerous. And that got the Attorney General concerned. And they tried to find the leaker. And they were not having any, they tried in lots
again,
of different ways.
Again, is there culpability there if the requests were too broad?
Well, I don't know what you mean by culpability. I don't think it would be criminal to make too broad a request. I don't think the criticism is of the request being too broad. I think the criticism is of the request being made at all. The press has the idea that they are immune from any investigatory activity on the part of the police. How else do you find a leaker? I mean, you ask people, hey, did you leak? And they say no. Okay, now what do? If you want to find who was doing the leaking, assuming that it was important to find because the information was the kind of information which could result in some American being killed, some American CIA agent being exposed or something like that, or some operation being taken off track because of the leak.
The unconstitutionality or constitutionality of all of these. We'll even dive into Medicaid. We're going to get that next in the Think Tank.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Dr. Mike O'Neill, you do not make it easy for me. I'm telling you, I have to go to broadcasting school just to get the titles of our guests down. Here we go. Former Principal Deputy Solicitor General of the United States and former ASU Law Dean Paul Bender joins us. Thank you once again for being with us.
Thanks, Mike. You get to use all those big words.
So
I don't stumble over them. I got another big word here, and it's one that's thrown around a lot, and that word is unconstitutional. And we hear that all the time. I want to start at the basics, and I apologize. This is a pretty basic question. But when a law is declared unconstitutional, what does that mean?
It means it's invalid, it's void, it doesn't have any legal effect.
Because
it violates the Constitution. The Constitution is the set of rules. By the way, people should be aware that people in Arizona live under two constitutions. There's the U.S. Constitution and there's the state constitution. Every state has a constitution. And those constitutions set up the structure of the government, the powers of the government, the limitations on the powers of the government, the limitations on what government officials can do, and stuff like that. So if the legislature passes a law that they're not authorized to pass, or if the legislature passes a law that violates some individual right that's protected by the Constitution, and somebody takes that to court, and the court holds it's unconstitutional, it means the law has no legal effect, no legal force.
Seems, just by my reckoning, that seems to occur a whole lot more in Arizona than in most other states. Why is that?
I'm not sure that's true, although it might be, because Arizona certainly recently has had more than its share of cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, and they've also had a lot of cases in the lower federal courts. The Arizona legislature has done some, I don't know how you want to describe it, pushing the envelope kinds of things, treading on the edges of their authority. And also, the Arizona legislature seems to think that it's at war with the United States government. And so they have done a lot of things that are arguably inconsistent with federal law. And the Constitution says that when state law and federal law are inconsistent, when they conflict, federal law prevails. I don't think a lot of people in the Arizona legislature understand that. Or if they understand it, they don't really care about it because they're doing things not so much because they want them to have legal effect ultimately, but to make a statement.
Just this week, case in point, Arizona Appeals Court, it wasn't the Supreme Court, but an Arizona Appeals Court tossed the Arizona abortion law, which said that abortion blocked abortions after 20 weeks, but it's 20 weeks from the last menstrual cycle. So by my calculation, that really means 18 or 16, somewhere in there. Case in point, just this last week.
Except it was not the Arizona Court of Appeals. It was the United States Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit.
Yes.
But that's not the Supreme Court. Right. They held that that law is unconstitutional. And the reason it's unconstitutional, they said, and I think they're clearly right, is that in Roe and Wade, a very controversial case, but one that has not been overruled and is, I don't think, is about to be overruled, the Supreme Court held that a woman has a right to an abortion until the fetus is viable. And she can have it if she wants to get it, and a doctor is willing to do it. It's an absolute right. And the Arizona law said that after 20 weeks, and you say it's 20 weeks from the last menstrual period, after that time, a woman does not have a right to an abortion. Well, that's in conflict with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision that there is a right to abortion up until viability, because nobody thinks that fetuses are viable at 20 weeks, even if it's 20, certainly not at 18 or 16 weeks. So that law on its face is in conflict with the Supreme Court precedent, which is controlling.
And we just catch the headlines that we say viable, when a fetus is viable. What does that mean? Is it defined?
Yes.
When these rulings are passed down, is viability defined? And what is that defined as?
Roe and Wade defines viability, and it says that the viability means that the fetus is capable of life outside of the mother's body, naturally or even with artificial means. So if the baby, if the fetus after it's born can live, even in an incubator, then the fetus is viable. But there's a time when if the fetus is delivered before a certain time, it's never going to be able to survive. And that's the line of viability. The problem, of course, is that it varies from fetus to fetus and woman to woman. And so you don't know exactly when the fetus is viable. But the rule is the doctor's got to ask himself or herself, is this a viable fetus? And if it's a viable fetus, then the state is entitled to tell the doctor, you can't abort that fetus unless the abortion is necessary to save the life or preserve the health of the mother.
And I think medically, since Roe versus Wade, that moment has been evolving as medical technology has improved.
Right. That time has gotten closer and closer to conception, but it is not yet at 20 weeks. And so when a state says 20 weeks is a fixed, rigid rule, that ignores the fact that the constitutional rule is you have a right to an abortion until viability. And so the court says it's unconstitutional. So if that stands, and the question is whether the U.S. Supreme Court is going to review it or not, or just let it stand by denying certiorari.
Now, cases like this often end up with people making the following argument, and I wonder, if, as a lawyer, if you'd address this.
Yeah.
They're saying, well, the court has done, these unelected judges are changing the will of the people as expressed by their elected legislators. How would you respond to that?
They are. That's what the Constitution is for. One of the things the Constitution is for is to put limits on government, and those limits are enforced by the courts. That's been true since Marbury and Madison, which is in the early 1800s. And I think everybody accepts that in the United States, that the courts are the ones who decide whether the laws are constitutional. And the Constitution is there to put, in part, to put limits on the legislature. So when the elected legislators do something that the Constitution prohibits them from doing, for example, they abridge the freedom of speech, or they abridge the freedom of religion, or they authorize unreasonable searches, or they authorize cruel and unusual punishments. When they do that, even though it's a majority of the legislature, and by the way, this applies to things that are passed by citizen initiative also, The court's job is to apply the Constitution. And if what the legislators did is in conflict with the Constitution, the courts have to say it is in conflict.
You know, this reminds me of a personal observation that this was a newly elected legislator who was confronted by an argument like that. And his response was, well, I knew that was the law. I just didn't think it applied to us.
What do you mean by us?
Us meaning the legislature.
Yeah, well, it does. It's mostly to apply to the legislature. They're the most dangerous body in terms of dangers of violating people's constitutional rights.
Let's quickly take up the case of Medicaid. You think that if Medicaid, the governor's Medicaid proposal passes, that it is at some risk to be struck down by the courts. Why?
Well, there is an argument that buried in there is a tax. And under the Arizona Constitution, the legislature is not allowed to raise taxes unless it has a two-thirds vote of the legislature. And as you probably know, they did not get a two-thirds vote in the Senate, and no one thinks they're going to get a two-thirds vote in the House. So if that provision is, in fact, a tax that needs a two-thirds majority, that tax provision could be challenged.
In your opinion, is that the case? Because the other side has argued that's a fee.
Yeah, well, the fact that it's a fee doesn't matter because fees are covered as well. Mm-hmm. But there is an exception in the constitutional provision for taxes that are levied by administrative officials or agencies who are given the authority to levy the taxes by the legislature when the legislature doesn't state a formula or a limit. They leave the tax up to the administrator. And the argument that the governor is making, and I think it's a powerful one, is that this is one of those taxes that's exempted from the two-thirds.
The bottom line, I think, even if this one passes, it probably goes to court where the result is indeterminate.
Well,
That is the bottom line. But not only is he a former deputy solicitor general, not only is he the former ASU law dean, he is also formerly a U.S. Supreme Court law clerk. We are going to weigh in next on the agenda of the Supreme Court. It is the Think Tank.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Here, just racing right through it. There's a lot to get to. The Supreme Court agenda is up next.
Well, just before we get to that, Professor Bender in the break was making a point that he thought really the most important about Medicaid expansion is.
The most important legal problem with the Medicaid expansion, I think, is whether it's subject to referendum or not. Most things that the legislature does is subject to referendum. And if a referendum petition is taken out and they get enough signatures, and they don't need that many, I think it's about 80,000, then the legislation goes on hold until the next general election. Next general election is November 2014. And so that would mean that the Medicaid expansion could not take effect right away. It could only take effect if the voters approve it in November 2014. I think the federal Medicaid legislation requires the state to make up its mind whether it wants to participate in the Medicaid expansion by the end of this year.
So in all likelihood, then, that doesn't happen because I think you cited 80,000, and that's nothing in terms
of there is a solution to that, by the way, and that is to pass it not as a statute but as a proposed constitutional amendment. That would go to the voters, but that could go to the voters right away at a special election. Mm-hmm. And so the voters could vote on it before the end of the year, but apparently the legislature has not gotten interested in
if they have the votes to do that.
Right.
Okay, moving to the Supreme Court, a lot of interesting stuff, some of it directly relevant to Arizona. Arizona Prop 200, right, which was a provision that provided a proof of citizenship in order to register to vote.
Right.
You think that that's liable to get tossed by the Supreme Court. Why?
Right. Because there's a federal statute. We're only talking here about federal elections, by the way. The states can do what they want with regard to state elections. We're talking about elections for senator and Congress. And usually people, when they register to vote, register both for federal and state elections. So if there's only one registration, it's all elections. But the state could exempt itself from the federal law if it wanted to by having a different rule for state elections. The federal law says that you are entitled to register to vote in federal elections without having to prove affirmatively your citizenship by bringing a birth certificate or something like that, that the way you do it is you swear under penalty of perjury that you're a citizen. And if the state wants to challenge it, it can do that. But the federal law, to me, seems to say that you have a right to register without having to prove citizenship. And Arizona has passed a law saying that you cannot register to vote without bringing affirmative proof of citizenship. And so that's being challenged in the Supreme Court as a law that's inconsistent with the federal
voting. Most of
the
stuff, the facts I've seen brought to the bear on that is that the number of instances of people falsely swearing to that they're legal to vote is virtually negligible. Is that?
Well, that is what people say, and I think it's probably true, that there really is no need for this because there's not a great problem of people registering who are not citizens. But that's really not relevant to the legal issues. The legal issue in this case is whether the federal statute prohibits a state from requiring affirmative proof of citizenship. And it's a question of interpreting the federal statute. It's not an open and shut case. It could be either way. The Ninth Circuit, in a very careful opinion, said that the federal law said you can't require proof. And that seemed to me to be the right answer. We will find out within the next couple of weeks whether that is the right answer.
Some other ones we're going to find out. Two gay marriage-related cases before the Supreme Court. Talk about those if you want.
Well, the one that's most well-known is the case from California, where after the California Supreme Court had struck down California's law banning gay marriage as a violation of the California Constitution, the people of California adopted a constitutional amendment which prohibited gay marriage. We have such an amendment in Arizona as well. And that was attacked as being inconsistent with the Equal Protection Clause of the federal Constitution. And that issue is before the court. And the other one is there's a federal statute called the Defense of Marriage Act, which is really an attack on gay marriage. And it says that for federal law purposes, it doesn't matter whether a state recognizes gay marriage, but only heterosexual couples are married for purposes of federal law. This case involves a woman who had a married partner. It was a Canadian marriage, but it was recognized in New York where they lived. And they were married, and one of them died and left a lot of money to the other one. If they were married, there would be a marital deduction on the estate tax. If there's no marital deduction, there were, I think, $350,000 due in estate taxes, which would not be due if there are marital deductions. And so the woman is claiming that the federal law is unconstitutional because it is inconsistent with state law and states have the right to decide who's married and who's not, and also that it violates the Equal Protection
Clause. Well, you're
an
astute observer of the court. Would you care to handicap those cases?
No.
Okay, I'll move on. There's an affirmative action case. Could we see the court modifying it?
You could definitely see the court. Yeah, the court several years ago said that a law school in that case, and I think they meant it to apply to all postgraduate institutions, could use race as one of many factors in deciding who to admit. The University of Texas is doing exactly that. So you would think there'd be no problem since they're doing what the court said they could do about 10 years ago. The problem is there are two problems. One, the membership of the court has changed since then. Specifically, Justice O'Connor, who was in the majority of the case that upheld the use of race, has left, and Justice Alito has replaced her, and he is very much against the use of race. So they might overrule that case. And even if they didn't overrule it, the case before them is a Texas case where Texas, when it thought it could not use race and still wanted to have meaningful diversity in the University of Texas, decided they could do it without using race by automatically admitting the top 10% of every high school in Texas. People who finished in the top 10% had a right to go to the University of California.
Does the same thing.
And because the schools are segregated, that means that you get a lot of diversity when you do that. So the argument is that, hey, they already did that without using race. And so when they come along and say, okay, we, in addition to that, want to use race in order to get more diversity or to make sure we have diversity in the different majors and the different colleges, that was unnecessary use of race. And so you could strike down the Texas program without overruling the Grutter decision, which was the one that held that you could use race. So that's a big case.
To what extent can a court say, well, that was a reasonable remedy for a certain period of time, but that time has really passed? Is that permissible?
Oh, sure. The Supreme Court can do anything.
Because there's no other court to review.
There's no rule of permissibility with regard to the Supreme Court.
One of the other ones coming up is the Voting Rights Act. And particularly, when you say Voting Rights Act, people think of the right to vote and all that. But there are other provisions, particularly Section 2 and 5, which relate very strongly to the dilution of minority voting rights. In other words, which force you to have districts that have a certain percentage of minorities in it, that you're not allowed to dilute that or weaken that.
Well, the section that's at issue is Section 5, and that doesn't force you to do anything. What it says is that you're not allowed to make a change in the law which dilutes the existing minority voting strength. And in order to do that, since the southern states were doing that all the time at the time this was passed, which is 1965, Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act says that if states come within the formula, which was designed to fit the southern states that had been hostile to minority voting, that every change they make in their voting law or regulations has to be pre-cleared with the federal government before it goes into effect. And the pre-clearance is to make sure that it doesn't lessen minority voting.
I think one of the invidious impacts of that is to take it in the Arizona context. If Ed Pastor gets 70% or 80% Democratic, mostly Hispanic votes, and you're not allowed to take any of those away, that means other districts may be precluded from becoming electorally competitive.
It's possible, although I don't think that's true. I think there are ways to preserve both the minority voting strength and competitiveness. But that would be the issue. If, for example, it's the issue right now with the redistricting plan that is being sought pre-clearance now, the federal government is going to look to see whether that redistricting plan significantly lowers minority voting strength. If it does, they have to say, hey, you can't do that. You got to come back with a different plan.
Do you think there's a chance that the courts will basically outlaw that provision that says you can't delete?
Oh, yeah, there's definitely a chance.
All right. Well, that is a lot to cover. Once again, former Principal Deputy Solicitor General of the United States and former ASU Law Dean Paul Bender. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Bender. I really appreciate it. Your insight has been absolutely invaluable. Dr. Mike O'Neill and I, after a quick break, we're going to tie a little bow around this right here in the Think Tank.
You're listening to The Think Tank on The Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Once again, a sincere thank you to former Principal Deputy Solicitor General of the United States and former ASU Law Dean Paul Bender. Thank you so much for joining us. And, Doc, I'll tell you, we talked about the thing that jumps off the page here as I look at it and I review my notes here is constitutional versus unconstitutional. Professor Bender also brought up U.S. Constitution versus state constitution. A lot there.
My take on that, and really I think what not everybody always gets, is that the Constitution is basically our fundamental agreement about the laws of the game. These are the rules that we agreed to play by, and we agree that there's certain things we can't do. For example, to throw a little bit of Latin that'll lose you, ex post facto law. What does that mean? What does that mean is we cannot arrest you for something that wasn't at a crime at the time you did it because we make it a crime later on.
Oh, okay.
That would strike most people as a very, very reasonable thing.
Crime doesn't have a grandfather clause, is what you're saying.
Essentially, it has to be illegal when you do it. That's just one example. Right. But there's a whole lot of things. Essentially, what in fact most of our Constitution was about, not protecting the majority. The Madison and others who wrote the Constitution, majorities are pretty much able to take care of themselves. But there are groups that will get dumped on for a variety of reasons at a variety of point in time. And what all of these provisions do is constrain the ability to dump on groups that are unpopular or smaller. And those are rules of the game that we agree to play by. And what the role of the court is to deal with the passions of the moment that may be reflected in the legislature and say, wait a minute, no, that's not playing by the rules. You can't do that. You can't do that, not because I don't like it personally, but because it's not in accordance with the rules that we all agreed to play with. And that's when something is declared unconstitutional, That's what that is. And what Professor Bender pointed out is we got two sets of the rules. There's the Arizona Constitution
sure.
and the U.S. Constitution. In some cases, the protections in the Arizona Constitution are actually broader than in the U.S. Constitution.
And we seem here in Arizona, at least from my standpoint, we seem to be the flag bearers for testing the waters versus to challenge federal law with Arizona state law. How does that fit into the Constitution?
We've got a lot of legislators who are pretty openly hostile to federal role in a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And so they constantly push the envelope. I mean, the case we mentioned, the abortion case, Roe v. Wade said, you know, if the fetus is viable, you can't not interfere with that. They don't like that for a variety of reasons. And what you see is a whole bunch of laws that attempt to push the envelope and say, well, what about this? What about this? What about this?
They tend to get
bounced.
Professor Bender did bring up the fact that viability, it varies from mother to mother, to baby to baby.
And I think he pointed out that's why a law that says, you know, anything after...
Give it a date.
When you give it a date, you're being too... That may not fit. And if it doesn't fit what the Supreme Court said is viability is the rule.
Right.
You'd do anything other than that, and it may be unconstitutional.
And then viability seems to keep getting with medical advancement, seems to get pushed closer and closer to conception.
Which means that's where
states are coming in and saying, hey, wait a second, we just had a baby live and it's this age.
Yeah.
After, you know.
But
so,
I think where they get in trouble is putting a date on it.
Right.
Though recognizing that the standard has moved earlier because viability has moved earlier.
Well, let's back up the cart a little bit here. And at the very beginning of our show, we talked about IRS. We talked about AP, and we tried to get to Benghazi. I don't think we got there. Questioning, really, with the IRS. We talked about nothing was done illegally, right? Nothing illegal happened.
Mm-hmm.
Some might argue, and I know Professor Bender was arguing, that this might be the way it should be done just to get things done properly. We segregate different files and we give some attention.
I think the political side that he really didn't address is that when the IRS does something and they don't come down evenly, it is politically touchy.
Mm-hmm.
It gets very – now, if there's a hint that the president ordered this or anybody in which there is not anything, there's mm-hmm. nothing but suspicion on that.
Well, because everyone from top down saying they didn't know anything,
well,
even the IRS.
Well, there's two interpretations of one of that is maybe they didn't. You know,
I would say the president. I'm just saying the people with IRS on their business cards are saying they didn't know.
At what level? I know the folks in this office had a doubling or tripling of the number of applications in eight that they had to process, and no increase in staff. And I could see a bunch of people sitting around saying, we've got this massive stack of applications. How are we going to figure out which ones are political and might therefore be worthy of more tighter scrutiny? I could see an innocent explanation for that. I think it was ill-advised.
So the only fallout we're seeing, because we're talking legal matters here, so the only fallout that we're going to see, if we see any fallout at all, is going to be politically. We're not going to see legal fallout from this because, as far as even I can see, don't see a lot of legal problems with this.
That's what we heard from Professor Bender, that I think there's not really legal issues involved. They're political to the extent that you can make, you know, you say IRS, and I think people, you know, the IRS can just, you say the word, you get a letter from them. It's sort of like you're driving along and the red bubble comes on behind you.
Right.
Your heart starts beating, you say, what did I do, or what can they make me? They can make you fill out a lot of forms. And that was also the result of this case. There were some groups that had to answer some questions. Nobody was denied. First of all, they were not even questioning tax exemption. They were questioning whether or not they got this special status that allowed them to hide their donors. And ultimately, nobody got denied.
The bottom line is no laws were broken. This goes, once again, political fallout will be the only fallout from this.
As far as we can tell, yes.
The Supreme Court came up. I was in particular, I was excited to hear about voter ID laws and then Defense of Marriage Act as well. Let's start with the voter ID laws. What was your takeaway from Professor Bender?
Well, that's an Arizona law.
Correct.
And what I heard is that there is a decent chance that law will get overturned and that the rationale for overturning it will be that it conflicts with federal provisions for what you need to do in order to vote, and that when there is a conflict with federal provisions, the federal provisions prevail.
Why is voting any different than, and Professor Bender, you can jump in on this if you'd like to. Why is it any different? Why do I not need ID to vote, but I need ID to do darn near everything else I do. Why is voting different when voting seems to be the most sacred thing that we have here in the country?
Yeah, actually, the Arizona case isn't about voting. It's about registering to vote.
Okay.
The ID law was upheld by the Supreme Court,
okay.
a law like ours. So the question is whether, why is voting different from other things?
Or even registering to vote. Why would register?
Well, because
it seems
citizens,
to be one of our most sacred things.
And only citizens are allowed to vote. Mm-hmm. And so in order to register to vote, you have to be a citizen. And the question is, do you have to prove that you're a citizen? Or is the burden on the people who don't think you're a citizen to show that you're not? The federal government passed a law called the Motor Voter Act some years ago, which was intended to make it easier to register. We got a problem in this country, mm-hmm. and that is that only about half the people who are eligible register. And the federal government wanted
really.
To encourage more registration. So mm-hmm. it passed a law that made it very easy to register and said states must not require people to bring affirmative proof of citizenship in order to register. Can you prove your citizenship?
Yes.
How?
My passport and my driver's license.
Well, the driver's license doesn't really do
it. Oh,
it
doesn't?
Passport.
How's my passport?
Yeah.
All right.
Not
good.
Everybody has a passport.
Well, and there, I think, we get into some
and
of the
rough. And a birth certificate. I got it all. I've got it all.
A passport is something that is going to be held by somebody middle or upper middle class. Even a driver's license, which isn't sufficient, is more likely to be held by people who are under a certain age. You get to be 80, 85, you stop driving, you don't have that. But that doesn't cut it anyway. There are correlations between having these documents and race and income.
And that's interesting. I need to do more research on that because I haven't done a lot of research on that. I hear a lot of headlines about that on both sides, that it's race, it's not race, that it's income, it's not income. I'll tell you, it's a hotbed issue, and I'm glad the Supreme Court's taking it up. Defense of Marriage Act, they just don't want gays to get married. Let's be real.
Well,
this is a bottom line or no?
Well, does the court want that? I think that what's coming is that it is intellectually harder and harder to justify prohibiting gay marriage in terms of the 14th Amendment, but we're having really a rush of cultural change. And the question, I think it's coming. The question is, will it come by the court? California, the oddity is they're facing a California vote that said you can't do it. I think if California revoted, it would pass this time.
Well, you can find blogs, articles, and links on MikeO'Neill.org or visit O'NeillResearch.com. That is his Mark. That's his day job, marketing research and analysis. We want to thank our very special guest, former Principal Deputy Solicitor General of the United States and former ASU Law Dean, Professor Paul Bender. An amazing and a very informative think tank. I'm excited it went down. Thank you so much for spending a little bit of your time with us this week. And once again, hit the pool. Make yourself a margarita. It's hot out there. Let me tell you. This is on behalf of Dr. Mike O'Neill. I'm Mike Russell. Thanks for spending some time in the think tank.